Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
That would get Kate. I don't even know who that is.
All right, welcome in, everybody, to another episode of the Always Soccer in Philadelphia podcast as we get set for a new Philadelphia Union season in 2022 and making his return to the program. We appreciate him coming on again. It's Philadelphia Union head coach Jim Curtin. Jim, how are you?
Doing good, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I think you said last time that you thought there was going to be more drinking involved in the podcast. Unfortunately, we're recording at 11:34 in the morning, so I just have water. I would crack a beer if it was later, but I haven't drank it. 11 a.m. since West Virginia days,
It's the off season, so anything after 10 a.m. is fair game, I think.
That's true, right? Although if I was, drunk and writing for Crossing Broad, we might have an interesting result on the website. So,
your commenters seem drunk all the time. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, I think that's another podcast for another time. I could go on and on about that for level of responses that we get on social media, We'd like to just shut that down entirely. But anyway, we're not talking about any of that right now. We're talking about my favorite sport, soccer. This is my safe space for talking about the game that I really like, and I appreciate you coming back on. And I'll just say, first off, congratulations on another great season, semifinals of the playoffs, semifinals of the Champions League, amazing achievements. And it was fun to watch along the way. Obviously it didn't end how everybody wanted it to end. And I would just ask if you have found peace with that, or if you've been able to bring any closure to the COVID situation, or if it's something that still pisses you off.
Yeah, I think we'll never have complete closure, just because, like in a lot of sports, it's the what ifs, and we'll never really truly know what it would have looked like with us at full strength, with New York City at full strength in our stadium. So yeah, I'm not gonna lie to you and say, it's in the past and we're moving on to next year, because again, there's so much, unknown with the situation. I think we navigated and handled it the best we could. It was, back to your first part, it was a great season. It was probably our most complete season, from start to finish, with, gradually getting better throughout the year. The run in Champions League, like you mentioned, the stadium against Club America, where even when you go back and look at that two-leg series, we're a couple self-inflicted wounds away from taking one of the best teams that there is in our region, to giving them a real run for their money. So I was proud of that run. I think we learned a lot in those games. We got a lot of experience in elimination games, and that helped us in the playoffs. Look, it's no secret that getting home field and being in Subaru Park for the end of the season was our goal. And once we got past that tricky Red Bull game, with obviously some brilliance from Jacob Blesnes, I think the fan base and the belief in the stadium, those were the memories that I'll always have. I know you were in, I think, for one of the games, or at least, if not all of them. But the feeling in there was different. It was unique. It was the loudest it's ever been. But yeah, we certainly still have regret, because as great of an effort as our group gave against New York City in that final game, and I think made the fans in the city proud, we all want to win, at the end of the day. And that wasn't us at full strength. You always want to be able to say you gave your best punch. I think certainly the guys on the field did that, but let's be honest, it wasn't our full team. That's for sure.
I was really proud of those guys, watching Aurelian go out there. He's like the same age as I am, and I'm like, hey, for him to, if that's the last MLS game he ever plays, that's a way to remember it, and
yeah,
Stewart stepping in, and Leon was a beast in that game. And I don't know. I feel like, even though the way it ended, there's a lot to be, happy about without those guys. Yeah,
I agree. So proud for sure. And again, we use Aurelian as the example, and I say this all the time, and I feel like young kids especially don't really listen or really understand what it means to be a professional. Anybody can be a professional when it's going good and you're winning and you're starting. Those are the easy moments. But for Aurelian, there's a guy that didn't play minutes for two seasons.
Yeah.
But still trained his butt off every day And in his brain, the way his brain works, he thought I was going to pick him every weekend. You know what I mean? And that's the true definition of what it means to be a professional. Always being ready, you know, you know, when you're called upon. And he really was and stepped up and was a great example for young players. And again, the performances in that game, I think only are going to strengthen our group. You know, Nathan Harriel, who we didn't expect a ton from this year, got a lot of valuable minutes to play in an Eastern Conference final. You know, I joked with him after the game. I said, look, man, I have a lot of great players and friends that I played with that never got to even play in a game like that in their careers, you know, and he's doing it early in his career. So again, huge experience for the guys, something that I think we were all proud of. Like you said, fans, media, players, staff were proud of, but at the same time, it's motivation for next year too.
Let's take it macro because that's one of my favorite topics and something that you and I have talked about, not just on the last time you came on the podcast, but when I was on the beat and I was down there all the time. And I feel my take is this. I feel like this year's team selling that playoff run, you made more inroads with the 4-for-4 type of fan or with the city than you did last year with the Shield. And the way that I would explain that is, you know, I would tell people, well, they won their first trophy. And then people would say, well, what's the supporter shield? And I have to explain the supporter shield to them. They're like, well, I don't get it, or that's dumb or something like that. But when you can speak a language that they understand, which is a playoff run where Jacob's scoring bangers or where the stadium's rocking or you're on national TV, to me, that just resonated more with Philadelphia than maybe the Shield team during the COVID season.
Absolutely. I agree completely. And again, I think there were, you know, we're still building our history. I know it sounds like we've been around for a while, but 10 years is 10 plus years is still young. And we don't, prior to the last two seasons, maybe we didn't have those benchmark moments. You know, everyone will remember the Glesnes goal. You know what I mean? And that's something that fans can look at and say, I was there, I remembered, I saw it, or whatever it was. Fans will remember the Andre Blake penalty saves. You know what I mean? These are moments that people will remember. People will still remember the craziness of the final game. They'll remember what it was like against Club America in that stadium. Those are real memories for people as we build our history. And like you said, in the early days, Kev, we were so inconsistent. And I think the Philadelphia fan and getting into that, cracking that 4-for-4 and being that fifth team now that everybody respects in the city took time. And what it really takes is consistency. So when I go back and look at it, you can remember the games in 2015, 16, 17, we would beat a team 4-0, then we would go get smacked 5-1 the next week. So there was no consistency. We were in the minds of people, then we were out of the minds of people almost immediately. I actually went back and looked at it, and it's the thing I'm most proud of our players, of our team, of our staff, and of the club. In the regular season now, since 2017, we haven't lost three games in a row since 2017. So that means now we're consistently solid. We might have a down game, but we're going to bounce back the next game. And I think that's what this city and Philadelphia fans kind of embrace, like just being consistent and knowing what you're going to get and giving everything each game. And to not be beat three times in a row since 2017, I think says a lot of our group and the improvements that the Philadelphia Union have made.
Well, at the same time, too, you defeat the outlier narrative, you know, for people who want to say, well, they had one good season they didn't play Seattle or Portland in the COVID year. Now people can't say that anymore because the season after winning the Shield, you went to the semifinals on the continent and in MLS Cup as well. So I think that goes a long way paired with the fact that we always talked about this on the podcast where it's like Philly sports fan. I think 4-for-4 is a bullshit term anyway. And I told Gargano this when he had me on the show, because I don't think Flyers fans really give a shit about the Sixers. I don't think Sixers fans give a shit about the Flyers. But if one team's really up or the other team's really up, they'll pay attention. But I think you guys benefited too from the fact that like the other teams were down at the time. And so that pulled a lot of natural eyeballs. And it was kind of like that perfect storm of you guys playing really well and enough of, you know, nonsense happening with the other teams, it was able to divert eyeballs at the same time.
It's very true. It's a great observation. And again, the whole 4-for-4 thing, I mean, I could have a whole discussion on Flyers alone. They're their own animal. You know, they kind of, they only like the Flyers. And look, I'll jump on, I like the Flyers too, but I tend to jump more on the bandwagon when they make a run in the playoffs, but you're right. I guess the best way I can put it is, people can talk and say soccer's this or soccer's that, but the reality is it's here and it is not going anywhere anymore. You know, it is coming. And if you want to get on board, get on board. If you don't like it, that's fine too. But it's inevitably here to stay. You turn on the TV, there's English League games. I can watch, I can turn on my TV right now and watch second division games all over the world, and it's on ESPN. So look, it's a great sport. The rest of the world obviously gets it. I think more and more people in Philadelphia are getting it, but there's still going to be a certain demographic that I'll just say isn't going to change. And that's okay. We don't need those guys.
Jim, what's the process like after a season ends? Do you and Ernst meet up with Jay? Do you go see him in New York, or does Richie get involved? Like, how do you guys kind of hash out the season and kind of like parse what just happened and plan for the next year?
Yeah, it's a good question. It gets broken down. You know, we obviously have player meetings at the end. You know, it always comes to an end abruptly, you know, no matter what, for everybody, unless you obviously win MLS Cup, then you party a little bit. But, you know, obviously, you know, it ends. We have meetings with myself, Ernst, you know, formerly Chris, and we kind of sit with each individual player, put together a plan for them for the off season. They have their physical work that they're going to do in the off season. And then, yeah, there's owners calls weekly. So myself, you know, Ernst, Tommy Wilson from the Academy, Tim McDermott, you know, and the three majority owners are all on the phone, you know, quite regularly. And we discuss different things. The directions that we want to move, the strengths, the weaknesses of the team, where we think we can improve. And we kind of talk through those things. So, yeah, there's always a strategy in place. I think it's clear now, you know, what our strategy is. It's to build from within. It's to, you know, be a cohesive unit and prove we can beat, you know, any group of individual talent, and then be a little more innovative. And that's something that we want to build on as we move towards a new season. But certainly the dialogue, the processes, you know, that gives you a little bit of a snapshot into, you know, who's talking on the phone, who's having the calls, and who's meeting. I did have a dinner with Jay Sugarman at the end of the year. It was very productive and good. And hopefully now we can put together, you know, another strong season. We're not sneaking up on anybody. That's something that we discussed now. There's nothing that, you know, when people used to play the Union, it was, you know, they knew we'd be tough to play against, but now we're talked about as a top team in our league, which is an honor, but at the same time, it brings different challenges because we have to constantly find ways to improve, innovate, and get better each season.
For people like me who work regular jobs, you know, if you're looking for a raise or a promotion or something else out of your boss, you would take what you did for that year, the year prior, and say, hey, you know, we had this many millions of page views and we did these kinds of stories and whatnot. Right. And you kind of present it to them as, you know, your case for getting a little bit more. Is that how it works in sports, or do you go to Jay and ownership and say, hey, we're this close, you know, we made it to the semifinals, we were this close to winning it all, you know, maybe like that little like final piece of investment might get us over the hump? Or is it more of a like collaborative kind of thing? How does that work?
I think we all talk about that. I think, you know, the game tells the truth, right? I think everybody that watched our team play could see we're close, you know, we're right there. So naturally our ownership knows that. They're always willing to invest, but they're not just going to throw money at things blindly, because you've seen in our league now that maybe necessarily doesn't always work. There's examples of it working, but there's more examples of it failing and money getting thrown around and wasted in a bad way. I actually just saw a statistic in terms of the DPs this year. There's 60% of the DP slots are open right now, which is a really kind of crazy number. Yeah. And I, in our own way, I think the Philadelphia Union has a little bit to do with that, because I think more and more owners are looking at us and going, well, wait a second, having three good players necessarily doesn't guarantee the rest of the roster being strong. It's probably the easiest, safest way I can put it. And I think people are reevaluating things, and that number I just saw it written and I couldn't believe it. So look, again, I know people want to, they see Insigne getting signed in Toronto and they think that, you know, why don't we just do that? You know, it's not in our DNA right now. It's not in our model, but certainly Jay Sugarman, when the time is right and we've proven that we can, you know, sustain things, I think I know that he will sprinkle in that big piece when it's needed. Again, right now I think we're in a good spot. We don't need just one superstar, isn't going to push it over the top or anything like that. So, and you see the risk that comes with that as well. You know, look at Kansas City, you know, an incredible player that I'm sure will bounce back, but now $10 million and he's lost for next season. So if you put
Jim's talking about Polito, who's out for the season. No, it's okay.
Actually everybody knows.
Yeah. Alon Polito out for the season with that knee, like I got after surgery or something.
Yeah. And look, Peter Vermes does a great job. He's an example of, you know, he gets the whole team going. They didn't just splash on one guy, but that's an example of a warning shot where it's not a guarantee, guys. It's really not. So we like the way that we're doing it. And when the time is right, whether it's two players, three players, whatever, the dollar signs and the number they want, we want to sprinkle in, Jay and our ownership will do that. That's for sure.
Kind of a three-part question here, but just like a housekeeping item. Anything you're comfortable, number one, anything you're comfortable sharing about the transfer market or what you guys are doing right now? Number two, replacing Pat as an assistant coach. And number three, are you guys going to have a technical director who kind of replaces Chris or does his job?
Well, the first and foremost, the first one, look, the transfer market, it's always going right now. Obviously, we have players that are, you know, a lot of teams in Europe are interested in. You know, there's players that we're actively pursuing. Obviously, you know, we're on guard in case we do lose a top piece at a certain position. We're able to replace them. But I would just, you know, tell our fans and yourself, and I think you already know this, this stage of the transfer window, you know, before January 31st hits, every agent in the world right now is telling their player that they're going to get them in a top five league, or you know what I mean? Once those promises start to fade and all the other teams sign guys and it gets a little later towards that January 31, all of a sudden I'll just say, for a lot of players, MLS looks a little more interesting. You know, if they're not going to Barcelona or Madrid like their agents maybe promised them, our league becomes. So what I'm getting at is this early phase of the transfer window, not a ton happens. And you can see that all over our league. It's pretty dead.
It's really not anything different, if I can draw a quick parallel here, to like a Ben Simmons situation where everybody's like, totally, well, you got to move him right now. Versus like you wait closer to the trade deadline, and obviously things open up as you get closer to February 10th.
Completely a great analogy. And when I say it gets chaotic in those last couple of days, it gets chaotic. You know, the almost signings, the ones that you thought you had that disappear, that wind up in another team. You know, it gets, I don't want to say dirty, but it gets crazy. It gets really heated. And you know, look, I'll be honest, most of it's driven by agents and most of it's BS, you know, so you have to navigate a lot of things. What's true, what's false, what rumors are out there. But because, look, it's big business. There's millions and millions of dollars on these transfer fees. So agents are going to do everything to drum up interest in their guys. You have to sift through what's real, what's not. You have people and you trust people like myself, like Ernst, who know how the league works, who has so many great contacts, and just know that, you know, look, there's going to be some things that happen. I can't give specific names on here, Kev. I apologize for that. But
it's all good. That's why I ask an open-ended question. I put the ball in your court, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we'd be stupid to do that. So nothing's really concrete right now. Even the interest in our own players, you know, I'll use as an example. You know, I read, you know, Kai gets linked to Watford and Udinese. Well, how many people in the world know that Watford and Udinese are owned by the same person, and Granada gets thrown in there? It's this web of three teams that constantly are coming up and get used as in transfer talk. So that's an example. There's millions of them out there. So again, until things are concrete, it's just talk. It really is just talk. As far as replacing Pat Noonan, look, that's almost an impossible task. Pat was an incredible assistant coach. We have a lot of really good candidates that Ernst and I have interviewed. We're going through that process now. There's a lot of good options that have MLS experiences. There's a lot of good options that don't have MLS experience that are, you know, from Europe or from the States. And then there's also options in-house right here in our own academy, which is something that obviously I'm partial to because it's how I got my start, you know. So, you know, we're getting closer to making a final decision, but the process has been thorough and a lot of really good candidates. You know, Chris would fall into the same ballpark. Not really a guy you can replace with one person. So I think you'll see us do that with multiple new people. So, you know, that's also an ongoing process. Chris did so much for this club, turning it into that consistent perennial winner that I talked about. I think it's no secret my relationship with him is about as good as it gets. You know, we grew up playing together when we were 14, 15 years old and have worked side by side now for the last, 8 or 9 years at least. So I always think it's funny. It's like when people come up to me and be like, hey, did you know about Chris? And I'm like, guys, Chris is my best friend in the game and literally has an office that touches mine for the last 10 years. We talk every day. So, yes, I was aware. You know what I mean?
Yes, I was very aware of that.
It's just funny sometimes that happens. I'm sure you experience it as well, but it's always that.
Well, I would just say it's funny too, because like MLS circles are very small. You know, and like you talk about agents and stuff like that, and like the gossip that gets passed around and the the trash that's put out there is just like very like transparent to see through. But I got to be honest with you. I've never said this before on the podcast, but like when I was getting some scoops back in the day, I never talked to an agent, not once.
Yeah.
Not a single time, because you just couldn't trust anything that like, there's always a motive behind it, you know, it's like always like for their client, you know?
Yeah. Look, I have a good agent and I like them, but give me off the topic of agents. I'll say something bad.
Let's segue into like the fun soccer tactical kind of questions that they don't ask you about much at the press conferences. You know, if I watched it, like kind of my takeaway from this year was, you know, defensively, you guys were amazing this year. You know, but it wasn't like the high press of like of Brendan's year, you know what I mean? And if I learned anything or had a takeaway, like I had a new like respect for how much running Brendan Aaronson did the year prior and how much that contributed to like reading cues and getting up on guys' backs and like pouncing on mistakes and sending that second guy. And I wonder if that was like a calculated, did you guys pull back from the high press like as a calculated thing, or did it just kind of happen?
You kind of have to based on the personnel that you have. Like you talked about, Brendan ran at a distance and at a speed that, when I say not many people in MLS can do, almost none in MLS can do, but now when he's even in Europe, he's running 13, 14 kilometers, which is as far as any guy over there is running, you know, and he did it at such a volume, it made it easy. Like, okay, he's going. Our system is based off the first guy getting pressure to the ball. He could always do it. So now everybody was pressing more together and higher. Look, so we had to adjust. We had to adapt. You know, obviously different personnel came in and we played a little bit different. I think Paxton, you saw, is starting to get more of that volume, where early on he didn't have the ability to cover ground. But now when the data comes back, he's getting higher and higher and closer to his brother. And he knows how we want to play now. I thought you saw Daniel Gazdag, who initially came in and was more of a tactical, you know, wait and see kind of guy. But now towards the end of the year, he was going and he was covering tons of ground and getting that first pressure to the ball rather than reading passing lanes. So look, we could talk about a million different ways, Kevin. I think you'll understand this especially as a defender. And I talk with Jesse about this all the time. I know it gets annoying when I bring up Jesse, but
no, it's all good.
When you really break it down, we can talk about formations for hours, and is what's different out of a 4-2, you know, 3-1 versus a 4-4-2 diamond versus a flat 4-4-2. It really starts with your back line. And I don't care. And I'm going to play more of a back three, I believe in the future. But if you choose a back four, if you choose a back three, or if you choose a back five, that's your starting point. The defenders control space and they step and drop based on pressure to the ball. So if we decide like we do, we play in a back four for the pretty much, I'd say 99% of the time. It's the job of the six. I don't care what formation they're in. I don't care what shape they're in. It's their job to get pressure to the ball. And based on that pressure, now the back four can squeeze. If it's a back three, it's the same thing, but it's seven guys hunting the ball in front of the three. You know what I mean? So really more than ever now, I think the modern game has gone to an area where the only thing that matters is what you decide to do with your back line, and the rest of the guys hunt the ball, you know, and make it predictable for the back four. And you can squeeze and have pressing cues, and you can I'll reveal our philosophy and our tactic is based on data. We put the weakest guy on the other team on the ball as much as possible. That's literally, it's so simple and it sounds so easy, but we want him to have the ball. We want him to make the game. So you'll see us now adjust. I was almost this close to using a name as an example, but I don't want to do that.
No, it's all good. But I appreciate the detail in there, because I think it helps articulate something I was trying to say on the post game show this year, which I think, like, I saw a lot of moments from you guys that were successful where they were like direct transition after winning the ball, but it wasn't necessarily from turning guys over in their own half of the field. You can win, Jose can win a ball, and then Sergio can go on a run and you can play direct transition to him right off of that win.
Absolutely.
Same with Jacob and same with Jack Elliott at the same time, you know? So whereas it wasn't like, I think everybody kept saying like high press. It wasn't like high press, but you can go direct transition based off winning the ball anywhere on the field.
Yeah, and if you think about it, teams are most vulnerable and open the second they lose the ball, because now they're in an attacking shape. They have their outside backs forward, and sometimes it's good to let them come a little bit, because it creates that space that you talk about in behind. So, we love teams that want to be really wide and open and expansive and keep possession, because we know eventually they're going to make a mistake. Soccer is a game of mistakes, and when we do turn you over – You're most vulnerable in those first 5 seconds after we steal the ball. So get it forward quickly.
I know you think that the idea of, like, you know, formation is a little overrated, and I would tend to agree, but I think, like, the main tactical wrinkle kind of that you guys have evolved from 2019 to now is, you know, when Ernst came in and you guys started in the diamond, you know, you'd often shift to the 4-2-3-1 in the second half, and you still had, like, overlap on the roster that left you natural wingers like Fafa, right, you know, or Alcino or whatever. And, you know, that's kind of gone away as the roster is, like, shaped to be more of what you guys want it to be. But now the wrinkle was going to the Christmas tree this year. And I'm wondering, like, if you like the Christmas tree and you think it's something that you're going to hang on to for next year, if that was more of just kind of like a product of circumstance.
Yeah, look, to your point, personnel dictates some things. So when we would change into the 4-2-3-1, we had a guy like Elsinho who could literally win us a game. And if you go back and look at that year, he won us like 19 points. Like, it was absurd. Yeah. It was it was an outlier of a year. It was off the charts. Obviously, he battled some injuries after that. But yeah, the luxury of having some wingers to change formation is a good one. I think it's something that we're talking about internally now to maybe adding, you know, one or two guys that give a little more pace and a little more 1v1 ability out wide. It doesn't necessarily have to be a winger, but someone who can beat the first guy. I think that's a real lost art in our game.
Yeah.
And it is really, really important as you look at it. But no, as we've evolved now to, you know, through the seasons from 19 to now, we have gone to that Christmas tree. And I'll be honest, going into it, we went out of it in necessity because we didn't have two forwards in form or healthy at certain moments. So we looked at the personnel and I was nervous going to it because the pressing cues are a little different because we usually target our pressing cues to the first pass to the outside back, and that's when we go. And now you don't have two guys to do that. You just have the one. Yeah. So Casper's job now became keeping it on one side, and Miro on the left would have to release all the way out to the outside back, and Daniel would have to come all the way over underneath to take away a six. They did it great and it worked. So, you know, these things, sometimes you stumble into them and you go, you know what, I actually like this. It, in certain moments, it's harder for teams to break us down. And when we win the ball, we have an extra guy centrally as almost like a second 10 in there. So has good and bad, no question about it, but it's something that I really did like. And especially when you only have one informed striker or one healthy striker at the moment, it's something that we can use.
I enjoyed watching it. And like, my listeners are probably rolling their eyes because I referenced this like 100 times before, but the only other like Christmas tree team that I could even really think of in the past is that AC Milan team that had like Gattuso on one side and like Ambrosini on the other side. But then I think they had like Seedorf and Kaká kind of like standing next to each other.
Yeah.
And but it's not like common. Like, I can't even really remember anybody else who played anything like that.
Yeah. And then look, you could call even that formation, you could call it a 4-1-2-2-1. You know what I mean? Because it looks that way with certain players. And Jose has an ability to be by himself, which is a lost art, really. There's not many guys that can sit there and cover the ground as a one in front of a back four that he covers. So that really helps us. And then Bedoya's intelligence of knowing when to join Jose, you know, it suited us and it worked good. But yeah, you could go through, gosh, some of those AC Milan teams are some legendary teams. They certainly had some.
My listeners can tell that. Yeah, like Nesta was one of my favorite players to watch ever. So I feel like I reference that same damn Milan team like every time I'm here.
But I played against that team sneakily back in my Fire days. We played them in a mid-season game, and it was like it was Nesta and Maldini were still there. I got to trade jerseys with Maldini afterwards. That was like, I almost cried.
Did you really? Did you go over there? Did they come 2005. Over here?
We played them in Soldier Field in, I think it was 2005. Gattuso was there. He was a maniac. I saw him in the locker room afterwards.
I saw AC when I lived in Atlanta for a couple months. I saw AC Milan play Club America down there. It's a preseason friendly, right? Gattuso got in a fight, tried to fight the entire Club America team, so that to me kind of told me what kind of play what kind of competitor he was, you know, fighting an entire 11 in a preseason game in Atlanta. But you mentioned Ali Bedoya. I have like an oddly specific question about him and Leon, because I think it's interesting, you know, when you're playing the diamond, you talk about like getting like attacking contribution maybe from one of those number eights, from one of the box to box guys, and like Leon put out so many fires and he was a great cue reader. I think he did so much well this year. I think we'd all probably agree that his offensive game really is fledgling, right? Because it's not he'd been a utility knife kind of hybrid guy, you know?
Yeah.
And on the other side, like, look, Ollie's not getting any younger. You know, he still makes a lot of his smart runs and like those incisive like reads into the channel and whatnot. But I'm curious how much the success of the Diamond is predicated on getting something going forward from at least one of the shuttlers, or if you feel like you can have two like more defensive minded guys in there and still create enough chances off of it.
Yeah, look, I think you'll see us this year utilize a Quinn Sullivan a little bit more. You'll see us utilize a Jack McGlynn a little bit more. And there could be instances where, you know, if you talk with Leon, his number one position is still as a six. He likes to sit in there. So we asked him to do a little bit more. He did great for us. You know, we've talked with him about improving certain parts of the attacking game. He actually runs and dribbles with the ball really, really well. I think he should actually do it more than he does. I think sometimes he plays a little too safe and he just wants to get the ball off his foot because he prefers the defensive side. But I think that'll be something that evolves with him. You forget he's still only 20. He's still a baby. You know what I mean?
He's
still
living
the game. He played so many minutes and did so great for us. Look, Ollie's been the lifeblood of this club. He's a leader. He's a winner. Every time you think he's going to slow down, he just puts in, you know, more and more minutes and covers so much ground. We do have to be smart with him this year, though, because we want him, you know, obviously playing in the biggest games at the end of the season as fresh as possible. But he'll want to play every minute of every game. That's just how he's wired.
Yeah.
But we will find ways to, you know, in certain games, if Jose's away with the national team, as an example, we have Bueno. You could pair Bueno and Leon in there together. You could put Ali in there because he's so smart and he can figure it out. So there's a lot of different options. I joke with Ali all the time. At some point, at the very end of his career, whenever that is, he'd be an amazing right back because his timing of when to get forward is really good. And he's smart enough. You know, Graham Zusi isn't the fastest 1v1, but he survives out there because he's so intelligent. And then I could see Ollie doing that for adding extra years to his career.
No, just, and I had Matt Doyle on the show during the year of armchair analyst from MLS Soccer. And we were trying to, I asked him, like, can you help me explain my Alejandro Bedoya take? Because I don't, unless you guys have second spectrum data that I don't have, I don't know how you package and like tweet or write about somebody's ability to recognize space.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's why I could never really elaborate on what Ollie does well, because I can't do it without just like showing you a video clip or something.
They're getting closer to that with the data, but they're still haven't perfected it. You know, they're starting to realize now these guys that move and create space for others just by their movement and being in the right spot. They might not get as many ball wins, but because they're in the right spot, they force the opponent to go sideways or backwards. They're starting to quantify that. So that's a stat that Ollie would all of a sudden become off the charts at, you know what I mean? Cause he's so smart out there. But yeah, they're working towards getting better at that, but you're right. It only shows up with the eyeballs, you know what I mean? What you see.
Yeah. Just a quick follow-up on that. And then I only got two more for you. Do you guys like data and how much do you use it? Is there something that you really look at? And is there another stat that's bullshit, or like, how do you look at advanced analytics now?
Of course. Yeah. Look, our third pillar is innovation. So we have to be at the cutting edge of technology. I'll give a little bit of insight with the second spectrum data that you had. We were on that 3-4 years ago. We had that. So for two full seasons under Ernst, we were getting that data when the rest of the league wasn't. So it was a real advantage for us. Now, granted, we could only get it in our home stadium because the cameras are different and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it was a huge competitive advantage. Fast forward now, the league cuts a deal with Second Spectrum. Now everybody has it.
Yeah.
So we have to innovate and move on and find another little advantage that we utilize. I think it's clear now we don't give a you-know-what about just possession as they measure it on a – it's a useless statistic. It's been proven, you know. Obviously, teams that are losing more are going to have the ball more. So you don't want to be, you don't want to lose. So
it doesn't
really equate. We want to know, you know, how, what you do with that possession and where is that possession and are you creating chances? Are you creating, we value penalty area entries a ton, you know, just the simple logic of more entry balls into the red zone, you're more likely to score. How many numbers do we get inside the red zone at any given time? We always want three bodies in there. We hope for five, you know, because just more chaos can happen when you get more numbers into that red zone. And then defensively, it's the same thing. You know, we constantly are talking about contact on clearances, defending the red zone. You know, we really have done a good job in the last several seasons of dominating that penalty area defensively and offensively. We've done a good job too. But yeah, there's a ton of advanced data and stuff that we could get into. We're very much into it. We have to be. At the end of the day, sometimes it can be overload. There's no question about it. When you get the 200-page stat sheet that's it, and then the final conclusion is, don't let Tadi Castellanos touch the ball inside the 12. It's like, yeah, I got it.
Yeah, no shit, right?
We understand. We got the idea.
Yeah,
but you have to sift through it and find the data that works for you. The one thing I would say in Philadelphia that we've done a really good job of, we've catered our data to us, not to the LA Galaxy or Toronto or to LAFC or Cincinnati. We do it to what suits the Philadelphia Union player, and that is more aggressiveness, ball winning, covering ground, the sprint data, all those things that we kind of put in and almost make the best way I could describe it, Kev, is actually like a quarterback rating. You know how they come up with a quarterback rating? You can call it BS if you want. Doesn't really matter. It does spit out a pretty decent metric of what that player is. Yeah. But we do that kind of for each Philadelphia Union position and each Philadelphia Union player. And we kind of break it down and we compare our guys to the rest of the league. Sorry for the long answer, but.
No, I appreciate it. Are you kidding me? I could go on forever, but I won't keep you forever. I only have two more, and we got to talk about center backs because that's the best position in the sport, probably the best position in any sport, if we're being honest. You played it at a high level. I played it at a very, very low level, but I think the last time you came on the podcast, I was just gushing uncontrollably about Mark McKenzie's 2020 season. And I feel like Jacob and Jack were phenomenal this year. And I don't know how I can describe this, so I came up with an analogy and a statistic. Andre only faced 11.5. You guys only gave up 11 something shots per game. I think it was you were almost bottom of the league and just allowing shots from other teams. Uh-huh. And Jacob and Jack just always looked like they were in control and just they were seeing the field and they were reading what was coming to them. And what I would say is that I don't feel like you even have to put out fires when you're not really allowing fires to begin in the first place. And I just feel like they did such a good job with mitigation that it was just impressive to watch.
Yeah. I mean, before I even talk about those two, I've said it 100 times to any coach out there that'll listen or any GM in MLS. If you have a good goalkeeper and two center backs, you will be in every game. You'll be in every game. You might not win every game, but it is critical. And center back, when you look out throughout the league, I'll just say there's a lot of bad ones. There's not a lot of good ones. So the teams that have good ones have success. And those two guys, knock on wood, are durable. They stay healthy. We're very fortunate even to have Stuart Finley, who was amazing when called upon as well, and is a starter anywhere else in the league. It's just a situation where we had two guys that had a great season. So the job that they did this year was incredible. They're dealing with top attacking talent, where everybody spending their millions and millions of dollars in our league is certainly on the attacking pieces. And those two have a really good partnership with each other. You have to remember too, Jack's playing on his weak foot on that left side and doing a great job, much like Mark McKenzie did as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, excellent. I still will say, sometimes this league is unfair. I think back to myself again, selfishly, I had probably my best season in 2003 and I didn't get any accolades. I was awful in 2004 and they named me an all-star, but they based it on your previous work. So yeah. I think Jack and Jacob, what I'm getting at is it takes a little longer for people to notice good defenders. And now I think they have enough equity and enough, time in the league that those individual accolades will come. Not that the game's about individual accolades, it's a team game. But they certainly deserve that kind of recognition and credit for the years that they've had. And again, Kev, you know it as well as anybody. The center back position, it helps to have good teammates as well. You need teammates around you. I'll use an example of Omar Gonzalez had a tough year this year in Toronto because he's called upon to make 25 plays rather than, five or six that he's used to when he was with the Galaxy. Watch now when he's now on New England Revolution this year, he'll look amazing because he is still a great player.
Yeah.
He's just not called upon to make a million different plays, and isolated in space like he was on a team that struggled. So
but if you think about like say Jack, for instance, he looks in front of him, he's got Jose standing there. He looks to his left, he's got Kai standing there. He looks behind him, he's got Andre there. He looks to his right and Jacob's there. You can't
yeah,
you know, be surrounded by a better group, you know.
There's no weakness, and that gives you confidence as a center back to say, you know what, I'm always going to go forward and be aggressive and defend forward. Not when defenders get in trouble is when they start to backpedal and allow these clever players to turn and face you, and you're backpedaling, you're dead. No one can defend that way. So again, yeah, the quality around you helps, and there's examples of it all over the world. You know, center backs usually are pretty cerebral and consistent. So I always think it's funny when people say all of a sudden certain guys can't defend or now they're good. It really is the guys around you that help you out as well.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the last one for you. It was actually a question I meant to ask you the last time. I just completely forgot, but it's something that I ask every like former coach or player who comes on the show. And what I would ask is, you know, fans and media like to talk about a lot of different things and might blow things out of proportion or might talk about things that they think are important, but you guys don't think are important. And I'm wondering if there was anything that the media or fans, if you think there's anything that fans and media focus on or put too much stock in, what is that? And what would you ask them to kind of focus on instead?
Oh, man, that's a tough one.
I'll give you an example. Like I asked Ryan Richter that question like 2 years ago, and he said he asked if people could pay more attention to like what people were asked to do specifically. Like you might criticize a fullback for not like bombing forward all the time, but maybe his coach didn't even ask him to do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like there's stuff that maybe we don't understand that you guys are privy to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to be more critical of the media, but no, I'm just kidding.
No, by all means. I mean, if there's a platform for it, it's this one, you know.
I'm totally joking. no, look, the one thing that does pop into my mind that always bothers me. This is more like a pet peeve than anything else. So I'm just venting my own opinions on things. When media do, and they do it in every sport, basketball, baseball, football, X team or X player hasn't won since da 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 da, and there's no context of like, well, how many times did they have they even played in that time? Like they'll include like the off season, you know what I mean? They haven't won in 7 months, and you're like, well, for four of them, we haven't played a game, you know? Like that one drives me insane. I think it's the laziest criticism, and I see it all the time in the NFL and NBA soccer too. It'll be like X team hasn't done X statistic in however long, and it grabs your attention because you're like, oh my god, they haven't beaten whoever in 4 years, and then you look back and you're like, oh, they played once and it went to overtime and they lost in penalty kicks. It's like, you know, it's not, you know,
or like Tom or like the Buffalo Bills haven't beaten, you know, the Jets lost X amount of times to Tom Brady when they were rolling out a backup and like they were playing the best quarterback of all time. You know, it's like the context lists like sexy, you know, tweets.
Correct. That one always gets me. And I want to always, when I see them, I want to speak up and speak out against them. But then you kind of go, you just sound like a complaining a-hole if I speak out against it. So I just, you just stay quiet and go, oh man. But those are sometimes they're a little bit, I'll just call them lazy statistics. I don't like lazy trends. You know, I think if you break it down and you say, and give the full context of why it's happening, I'm all for it. And I think criticism is needed and accountability should be there. But those blanket statements, man, I wish you could get rid of those.
Well, it's like fighting an uphill battle, you know. It's like you're never going to win that fight. It's like when Miles Sanders comes out and he asks Eagles fans to stop booing him. And I'm like, hey, he may have a perfectly legitimate, he may be 100% right here, but you're going like one versus like,
you're
going
to lose every time. And again, to any Philly athlete, coach, whoever it is out there, the players and coaches have never once ever, ever in the history of Philadelphia won against the fans. You know what I mean? So when you come out and say something stupid like that, you're going to lose every time. Even happened with Tobias the other day where he says the little blip to the fans. You're never going to win. So be smarter.
Well, it's almost like a rite of passage. Like you bottom out, you get booed, and then you play well and everybody's cool about it. That's a nice thing about living in a city where the fans do emotional knee-jerk reaction, because just as soon as you're on the shit list, you're right off of it again.
That's true.
Jim, listen, thanks. I appreciate the time. Congratulations again on another fantastic season. And you know, it was just nice to see, you know, like radio hosts tweeting about the union and going to the games and getting on the bandwagon and being supportive. And you just hope it continues into next year.
Yeah, I agree. I think in terms of growth in the city, you know, when you step back and look at it, I think this was our biggest step forward this year. You know, everybody, you know, was talking about us, you know, all the other teams in the city. And like you said, the media coverage was higher than ever. You know, you look at the Inquirer and you have, you know, three or four pages worth of soccer information. It's great. So we were happy with the year. We still know we have a lot of work to do, and this game can be very humbling. So the second you get comfortable, you got to recognize you can lose it just as quickly as you gained it. So great season, a lot to build on. Thank you to the fans for everything. And this was a good time coming on with you, Kev. I always appreciate your knowledge of the game. And it was you know, good conversation. It was fun to talk about some of the greater details of some of the positions and the tactics.
I appreciate it. I'm always happy to talk high-level center back talk with somebody who played at a much higher level than I did.
I just had good teammates, man. Like I said, back to my earlier points, I had good players around me. When Carlos Bocanegra and CJ Brown are on your right and left, it's an easy job.
Well, give yourself some credit, too. You know, those were good teams from 1 to 11 on the Chicago Fire, you know?
I was 11. I was the worst one. I can say that with confidence, but it was a good group.
All right, we'll leave it at that. Jim, thanks for the time as always, and we'll do it again, all right?
Thanks a lot.